Initially, there was a jurisdictional question that was raised in the court's initial orders, and unless there's any questions regarding that question, I will move to the substance of the case. I believe that they were answered. Thank you. As indicated in the briefs, I mean, this is clearly a personal injury case, and under Illinois law, there's basically three questions in a personal injury case: duty by the defendant, breach of duty, and harm occasioned by the duty. The only issue before the court today is that third issue in the personal injury case, harm occasioned by the breach of the duty. The parties spend a lot of time briefing and arguing about what constitutes a Daubert hearing, and I'll touch on that in a minute. But one thing I'd like to focus the court upon is that the case itself can effectively be decided outside the context of those arguments, because frankly, if we don't consider Dr. Fink and Dr. Cohn's testimony, which clearly Judge Bucklow did not, there's ample evidence in the record that these individuals who were exposed to this chemical and had some reactions to the chemical suffered injury. The facts in the record reflect that the two individuals were exposed to hydrogen sulfide, that Michael Lewis, one of the two plaintiffs, passed out for a brief period of time, and that Tammy Livingston felt the vapors and also received medical care that day. Dr. Metro, the initial treating physician, diagnosed a back injury for Michael Lewis, diagnosed some short-term lung type of irritation and injury, nausea, and those types of things. And also, as to Tammy Livingston, without the back injury, of course, diagnosed similar types of injuries relative to Miss Livingston. The parties then underwent a lengthy litigation, first in the Cook County Court and then in the federal court here when the second case was filed, in which numerous experts were called, numerous depositions were taken. And as indicated in our brief, if you excise what Dr. Fink and Dr. Cohn had to say in this case, there is evidence in the record that both of these individuals suffered some harm. As I pointed out, even Judge Bucklow's language in her order reflects an appreciation that Dr. Sweet, defendant's retained expert, found that Tammy Livingston, one of the two plaintiffs, suffered anxiety to today's date being at that point approximately 4 to 5 years after the incident. It caused her to double-check her actions and take actions that I would suggest to the court are suggestive of some emotional trauma. Frankly, if you look at those facts, look at the facts relative to what Dr. Metro said, what Dr. Kugel said, and what Dr. Moisan said relative to Michael Lewis's lung injury or the slight lung injury that they indicated, I think that decides the case for the court. There is evidence in the record of some harm, and the degree of harm and the degree of damages associated with what that harm should cause the plaintiffs to be awarded is a jury question, a fact question for the jury to decide. But it cannot be said that there is not a material issue of fact in this case, that there's some evidence of harm in the record. Turning to the more, I guess, interesting legal issue, the question, I believe, that is raised in the pleadings here is what constitutes a Daubert hearing, inquiry, proceeding, whatever we want to call it. Certainly, as the defendant notes to you, the cases don't necessarily require a hearing with sworn testimony where the doctors come in and testify. The court can, in fact, as noted in the Kirsten case, on a sua sponte basis, make a determination as to whether expert testimony is admissible based on following the factors in Daubert. My criticism of the trial court in this case is that that didn't happen. I believe and continue to believe that the proper approach is and should be that you first seek to strike the evidence. Once we know what evidence is or is not admissible, we then have the summary judgment motion and make a determination based on the evidence that is admissible whether there are tribal issues of fact in the case. It's not, I believe, a form over substance scenario where you're trying to make the court take an extra step, but it is, frankly, something that needs to be looked at in the context of what is admissible in a Daubert hearing versus what is admissible in a summary judgment motion. As we know, Daubert allows the court to consider hearsay. The rules of evidence don't apply. You can attach studies. You can do many things that the court can consider. Summary judgment motion, you can't do those things. It needs to be decided based on affidavit, the pleadings, the depositions, and record on file. And My concern with what occurred in this case is that with respect to the two plaintiffs' experts, I perhaps incorrectly argued to Judge Buchwald that she ought to do a Daubert hearing first, and a Daubert hearing meaning the full-blown hearing. But even if you look at what I argued to her as being an incorrect assumption of what she should do or what ought to be done in these types of cases, as you read the record, there's absolutely no reflection whatsoever that the trial court conducted an analysis of whether Dr. Fink or Dr. Cohn's testimony should be admissible. Particularly as to Dr. Cohn, the record reveals absolutely no suggestion by any expert that a licensed psychiatrist, an MD affiliated with the University of Chicago, is incapable of diagnosing conditions such as post-traumatic stress or anxiety, which is what he diagnosed in this case. If you review the trial court's decision and attempt to discern from it what occurred, it appears as though the criticism relative to Dr. Fink and his asthma diagnosis somehow led to a lumping of Dr. Cohn in with Dr. Fink as an expert who also has no basis for his opinions. One thing that's important to understand relative to Daubert is what Daubert challenges is the methodology as to how you got to the opinion, not the opinion itself. The defendant in this case at no point ever propounded or suggested any problem with Dr. Cohn's methodology. Dr. Sweet simply disagreed with him relative to whether she suffered post-traumatic stress versus anxiety. And then again, as I said, Dr. Sweet agreed that she suffered some anxiety. Turning finally to Dr. Cohn, which I think was the crux of the discussion at the trial court, throughout the proceedings, there was never a motion seeking to bar him as a witness, and a motion for summary judgment was filed in which, among other things, Dr. Struthers, a toxicologist, testified that I've done some research, and based on studies I have found, I don't believe that exposure to hydrogen sulfide can cause occupational asthma. Dr. Fink, as noted by counsel in their brief at both the trial court as well as at the appellate court, testified, I've done my research, admittedly brief, and I found studies which were, as an aside, in the record in the Rule 56.1 submissions given to Judge Buchwald, which stated that I have found studies which suggest that exposure to hydrogen sulfide can cause asthma. At that point, again, if Judge Buchwald's decision indicated she had done some type of inquiry into Dr. Fink's studies versus Dr. Struthers' studies and concluded for some reason that the Dr. Fink studies were not peer-reviewed appropriately, were not sufficient studies to allow him to render those opinions, there may be some thought in this case that then Dr. Fink's testimony as to Michael Lewis's asthma alone may or may not be considered in this case. Frankly, of course, our position is that he provided studies, Dr. Struthers provided studies. It becomes a fact question then for a jury to decide whether, based on the testimony of Dr. Fink, they find that his testimony is reasonable. But I don't believe, based on the tenor of the record, that under Daubert his testimony should have been stricken. I believe that pretty much summarizes the arguments I have. I don't know whether the court has any questions, but if the court does not, I'll defer to counsel.
This was all by deposition. I mean, in other words, the evidence for the doctor.
Yes.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
Weintraub?
Is the court, counsel, Your Honor. My name is Greg Weintraub, appearing on behalf of the appellee Sitco Petroleum. This case has been around for about 5+ years now. There have been ample time to develop the record on this, and I'd like to get into what opposing counsel addressed second, the issue of the expert testimony. There's no requirement that a motion in limine be filed to bar testimony in advance of a summary judgment motion. The law is very clear that only admissible evidence can be used to defeat summary judgment. And there are many cases in this circuit in which the court has considered the admissibility of expert testimony in the context of a summary judgment motion. The issue of the admissibility of Dr. Svinkenkamp's testimony was explicitly raised on the face of the papers. There was no question as to the nature of the argument, and plaintiff's counsel chose not to answer the substantive arguments as to the methodology and reliability of the testimony.
So your objection to the use of that testimony was based on lack of scientific basis?
Correct. There was no scientific basis for it, and Dr. Fink had no methodology for reaching his conclusion.
At the deposition, did you raise that?
He was questioned extensively on the research that he did and the basis for which he was able to draw a conclusion that hydrogen sulfide could cause asthma and that hydrogen sulfide in this particular case had caused asthma. With respect to the first question, general causation, he said that he did a 30-minute Medline search and pulled three case abstracts. Case abstracts are not the full study. They don't contain the underlying data. They don't contain the full description of the evaluation. And there's no control group, and in particular because these were case studies. And there have been cases at the district court level within this circuit where courts have said that case studies are not the best sort of evidence to establish scientific reliability because there is no control study. In this case, with abstracts, it's even more tenuous because we don't even have the full study. And then he also looked at two partial chapters from medical texts, which both described hydrogen sulfide as a respiratory irritant. Well, it can be an irritant without causing the particular disorder of asthma. Asthma is a specific diagnosis. An irritant can be a transitory effect, or it could be any number of other respiratory illnesses. Dr. Fink never made that connection. He didn't try to make that connection. He just simply asserted it as ipsy dixit, that I'm the doctor, I say that it can cause asthma, and therefore it did. With respect to specific causation, he said, well, the patient told me that he didn't have trouble breathing before, and he has trouble breathing now. Well, the temporal relationship by itself is not enough to make a finding of causation. That's not a methodology. We were dealing with someone who had been smoking for the better part of two decades. And respiratory problems evolving over time in a smoker are hardly surprising. And it was incumbent upon a doctor attempting to establish causation to at least consider that and rule it out. And Dr. Fink did no such thing here. And these arguments were all presented in the opening brief to the trial court. The plaintiff had every opportunity to make his arguments in defense of Dr. Fink's methodology, and he chose not to do so. He chose instead to rely on this procedural argument that it was somehow inappropriate for the court to consider admissibility at the summary judgment stage. There is no support in this circuit or elsewhere that it's inappropriate for the district court to do that. So plaintiff has waived this argument that that testimony is admissible because he did not argue that Dr. Fink's methodology was appropriate to the trial court when he had every opportunity to do so. Now, with respect to Dr. Cohn, the trial court's finding was the same. And you had an opportunity to argue why Dr. Cohn's testimony was admissible. As the proponent of the evidence, you have the burden by a preponderance of the evidence to establish that it is admissible, and you didn't even make any showing. Therefore, I'm going to find that it's inadmissible and disregard it. So, absent some showing, she decided that zero evidence on the admissibility side, she decided it was inadmissible. So, turning to the question of whether, in the absence of evidence from Dr. Svinkenkamp, there is sufficient evidence in the record, there plainly is not. Medical causation cannot be established by lay witnesses. And the witnesses that were retained by CITGO all testified to a lack of causation.
Well, didn't Dr. Kugel say that the exposure caused Lewis some symptoms?
Well, he said that the exposure did not cause injury in this case. He was talking about, he said that in certain cases, exposure to hydrogen sulfide could cause respiratory symptoms, but he said that the exposure did not cause injury in this case.
But didn't he also say that Lewis did have some symptoms as a result of his exposure?
I believe he was talking about just the symptoms that were reported in the medical records. He did not make a conclusion that they were related to the exposure. He just said that there were symptoms that were documented and that they may be related to it, but he didn't express a specific conclusion that they were, and as a matter of scientific opinion, related to this exposure.
And didn't Dr. Sweet also testify that Livingston suffered some anxiety as a result of this incident, low-level anxiety, but some anxiety?
His conclusion was that she did not suffer from the specific disorder of post-traumatic stress disorder. He said that she appeared to have she appeared to exhibit some anxiety, but anxiety is not a diagnosis. Anxiety is something that everyone deals with in daily life. He did not diagnose her with anxiety disorder. He did not diagnose her with panic disorder or compulsive disorder. There was no diagnosis of any recognized mental illness or mental suffering as recognized in the psychiatric literature. They just said she has some mild anxiety. She's anxious. It does not interfere with her ability to work. It doesn't require treatment. Anxiety is a normal factor of life. And he did not make any conclusion that she suffered any abnormal anxiety beyond what we normally contend with in our daily lives.
But these were the effect of the anxiety, the double checking, the things that she did at work she didn't do before. And Dr. Sweet's testimony is that this phenomenon related to or emanated from the March 11th incident. So isn't that a compensable injury? Even though it doesn't measure large on the scale of harms, it's not like losing a limb, I suppose, but no, it results from the exposure.
Well, having been involved in an incident and then and being more careful afterwards to double-check your work, that's what she was describing, that I double-checked to make sure that I've done everything. And that's not an injury. That's just being careful. I don't believe that represents a compensable injury, that someone says that, well, after this, I'm going to be more careful, and I'm going to go back and I'm going to double-check to make sure that I've done things. If she were compulsively checking and rechecking and rechecking and rechecking, that's a diagnosable disorder. That's a compulsive disorder, and that's not what Dr. Sweet concluded. He said that she has some anxiety, and she described how she now double-checks her work more thoroughly. And I don't believe that represents a harm as it does just a change in her conduct.
And procedurally, in this case, you move for summary judgment.
Yes.
With papers and support.
Yes, with papers and support.
And then the appellant responded but did not address your, as you point out, your issues of not lacking scientific basis and methodology.
That's correct.
And then the judge on the papers ruled in your favor.
That's correct. And as this court has previously said, the form of inquiry is within the trial court's discretion. The appellant has not explicitly raised abuse of discretion by the trial court as an issue. He just says that and that she didn't have a hearing and that somehow they are aggrieved by that. But there was no assertion that she abused her discretion in some fashion, and she has the discretion based on the paper record when the non-movement had an opportunity to present all of his arguments and did not do so. There are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Blank. How much time? You have 6 minutes, Counsel.
The court raised an interesting question to Mr. Weintraub relative to whether the scientific basis question was really raised in the pleadings, and I'll defer to the court's reading of the pleadings. But what's interesting is, as has been throughout the case on this motion, the arguments always seem to find their way to Dr. Fink and never to Dr. Cohn. If you read the pleadings, the initial pleading, the motion for summary judgment, there's a protracted argument relative to why Dr. Fink's testimony is not supported by the studies and why Dr. Struthers would say otherwise and so forth. And then the argument states, and oh, by the way, Dr. Cohn's methodology was bad too, period. Now, I understand what the law says relative to what a hearing and inquiry or whatever should be, but if the rule then is we can criticize an expert, not say why, not say what part of his methodology is inappropriate, and then require the non-movement to then have to go through a dissertation to prove that this witness's testimony is admissible, I think that turns Rule 56 on its ear. Summary judgment motions are to be decided based on accepting the facts in the record in the light most favorable to the non-movement, not to the movement. And I think that that's what the movement...
You have to throw in the burden that you have to support your evidence.
In that regard, in the record, was Dr. Fink's credentials and resume, a copy of his deposition in which he testified as to all of his opinions and the basis for the opinions. And frankly, in the record, there is no criticism from any witness, person, study as to his methodology. Again, it always seems as though Dr. Cohn's opinions and decisions are lumped in with Dr. Fink. And I'm not suggesting to the court that Dr. Fink's opinions are not credible either. But I am still flabbergasted as to why Dr. Cohn's opinions are stricken when there's absolutely nothing in the record showing a lack of methodology. The review of the trial court's Daubert decision is abuse of discretion as to the decision and the findings made. It's de novo as to the methodology of the trial court, for to use Daubert terms. And frankly, in this case, there is no methodology because there's no hearing. Counsel talks about waiver. What he is suggesting to the court is that we waive the right to a hearing we never had. Had Judge Bucklow gone through the proceedings in, for example, the Kirsten case that they cite, which says from this court that we don't require a specific form of hearing to occur, but we look at the trial court's decision relative to how it arrived at the decision. And this court in Kirsten talked about how that judge went through the methodology of going through the Daubert test, looking at what the expert had to say, looking at whether there was a scientific basis for it. And as I recall in that case, that was the individual who chose to mix some chemicals and kind of hurt himself. And the issue was, should a doctor, MD, be able to render opinions in a chemical field where chemists' knowledge and experience are necessary. That didn't happen here. Having said all that, and I'll close with this unless the court has any further questions, as the court correctly questioned counsel, there's evidence in this record of some harm to these people. Sitko has seemingly tried to convince the trial court, and apparently successfully so, that Illinois law requires some degree of harm, some permanency, some specific diagnosable injury. And that's not the case. If you're in an auto accident and your back hurts afterwards, you don't have to have a herniated disc. If your back hurts and you go to the ER room, you have a compensable injury. Might not be worth a lot, but it's compensable. The evidence in this record, if we divorce ourselves from everything relative to Dr. Fink and Dr. Cohn, is that Michael Lewis suffered some lung injury and a back injury. Tammy Livingston suffered some lung injury and emotional trauma, and I should say Michael Lewis is also diagnosed with emotional trauma by Dr. Cohn. And therefore, a jury should decide what that is worth, not the trial court. I don't have any further comments unless the court has any questions.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.